I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. The first weekend of March 2023, the UW-Madison campus and community held memorial services mourning the recent loss from cancer of former Chancellor Rebecca Blank. As another way to remember and honor Rebecca Blank, we rebroadcast this interview I did with her years ago when she was in the third year of her nine-year tenure as chancellor. Coming up, she discusses her parents' background, her love of economics, her concept of the Wisconsin idea, and her perceptions of what then was a fairly new role for her as chancellor of a large land-grant public university. Prior to becoming chancellor, Rebecca Blank served as acting U.S. Secretary of Commerce. She has a distinguished academic career, earning her Ph.D. in economics from MIT. One of her award-winning books is called It Takes a Nation, A New Agenda for Fighting Poverty. She became chancellor of UW-Madison in July 2013. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. Good to be here.
I'm always fascinated by sort of people's background, what got them into the area that they're in now. And I was wondering if we could start by looking back. I saw somewhere, I think it was in an On Wisconsin article, that your father was an extension agent. Is that right?
That's right. Both my father and my mother, though my mother stopped working professionally when her children were born. But both of them worked in extension. My dad started as a soil science expert and ended up in tourism and community development working in Minnesota.
And what do you think from your own background led you to the path you took of being fascinated by economics and then going from that to Secretary of Commerce and then ultimately here to Madison as the chancellor?
So, you know, I got into economics largely by taking a couple of economics classes in college and just finding them really exciting. I started as an English major. And I think when I look back on it, I'm not at all surprised I ended up in social sciences. So, you know, the surprise was I didn't know that enough about myself at age 18 to start there. But, economics, addressed all of these issues that I just thought were deeply important about work and life and poverty and what happens to people and incomes at the same time that it actually used mathematical tools to get there. And I was very good in math. And, you know, economics gave me the chance to actually work on the issues that I wanted, but not completely walk away from all the technical stuff that I found was really fun to do. And so I became an economics major and never really looked back from that. It was the right choice for me.
And as you serve as chancellor of this large land-grant institution with, what, over 40,000 students and big budget and so on, what kind of overlap do you see between what you're doing as chancellor here and the role, say, of Secretary of Commerce?
Well, you know, actually, these jobs are more similar than you might expect. You know, I was the Deputy Secretary of Commerce and moved into the acting job. And the Deputy Secretary is essentially the COO, the chief person in charge of managing the strategic operations of the entire Department of Commerce, which is a very large organization. It's a $10 billion organization. So that really gave me quite a bit of experience managing a large public organization. And while I'm not the one who oversees directly the human resources and the budget and other things, I was in that role for a while. And that's very, very helpful when you walk into this organization. You have to know when you're in this big a place, you can't keep your eyes on things. You can't do this through personally knowing people and getting knowledge from them. You have to know what questions to ask and what indicators to look at. So my work in commerce as the deputy secretary, I think, was very helpful to my ability to know some sense of how to manage this organization, what to keep my eyes on. On the other hand, my work as acting secretary was very similar to this job. You know, there you were in the leadership position. And I've often said that about my job here, and it was true of my job at Commerce as well. You have two roles. One is to explain the outside world to your internal constituents and explain to students and staff and faculty why we're dealing with the things we're dealing with that are coming at us. At the same time, it's equally important that you are the spokesperson for the organization to the outside world and explain to the rest of the world what is this strange place called a university and a Research One university and these things that you do in classes and why you bring the class together in the way it does. And, you know, the people have a lot of questions about universities. They're different from many other organizations, and they don't understand them. And I am, in some ways, the first spokesperson, the person most responsible for trying to explain the university to the world around it. And that's an incredibly important role, particularly at this moment in time.
And Bascom, where it's situated, where it's on the other end of State Street from our state capital, is kind of a symbolic location in a way. It's mm-hmm. up on a hill. Mm-hmm. It seems to be its own entity in a way, but we are a state organization at the university. How do you see the relationship between your office and Bascom and then down State Street to the other end with the state capitol?
So, you know, the university was created as part of the creation of the state. We started in 1848, like the state of Wisconsin. And this was not a university that waited until the land grants that were given by President Lincoln, even though that was very important to the university. This state decided early on, and if you go back and read the history, that you could not develop the state without having the educated citizenry that a university would provide. And we have been here 167 years, like the state, and have throughout that time been supported by the citizens of this state. We are deeply integrated with the state. And I take that as one of the real strengths of this university, and indeed the strengths of public universities everywhere, is that we are part of the community in a very real sense. Now, the Wisconsin idea, which mm-hmm. obviously has been around for more than 100 years since President Charles Van Hise talked about it, I am delighted to be at a place where the commitment to outreach is so strong we have our own name for it. You know, that we call it the Wisconsin idea. And I've said this in a number of settings. I've been at a lot of different universities in my life, and all of them to one extent or another give lip service to outreach. Of course, we do this in the community. I've never been at a place before coming to the University of Wisconsin here in Madison that lives that so intensely and that believes it so intensely. And, you know, in my first 6 months here, people would come up to me literally on campus and say, you do know about the Wisconsin idea. You do know that yeah. we're, you know, part of the rest of the state. And that's one of our real strengths. And it's one of the things that I'm not very happy about in this particular political moment is that folks seem to have forgotten a bit how deeply entwined we are with the state and all the things that we do, from our ag school, which has been absolutely fundamental to the agricultural industry here in Wisconsin, has some wonderful, wonderful, very close collaborations, to the things we do in our School of Medicine and its close collaboration with healthcare and clinics and industry all across the state. I mean, they're just, you know, hundreds of ways in which we are out in the state every day. And you know, some of that's just taken for granted. People don't even think about, oh, that person came from the university because that person comes every month, right? And
right.
and we need to remind people how this university is connected to the state. And we need to remind ourselves on campus as well regularly how important it is that we are part of this state.
One of my favorite examples, a very small one of the Wisconsin mm-hmm. ideas, I was doing a radio show as a guest, not as the host, about mm-hmm. women writers. And people could call in with questions after we aired a documentary. I think it was about the Bronte sisters. And I could hear cows mooing in the background mm-hmm. as someone was asking questions. And I think that notion that Charles Van Hise articulated about the boundaries of the university being mm-hmm. the boundaries of the state is really special. Are there some other examples that people might not think of? You know, we think of the agriculture, the extension folks going out and helping a farmer. What about some of the other partnerships or discoveries that have happened here at UW-Madison that affect people in their daily lives that they may not even know about?
Well, I will say we do a lot in the humanities, and particularly with high schools and with communities around the state, you know, bringing, you know, literature, theater, the arts, dance out around the state. And that's, I think, a really important part of the educational structure of the state is our involvement in that. And other schools in the system do that as well. You know, there are a wide variety of things that have happened here at Wisconsin that affects the state. This, I was just walking by the plaque as I walked into this building. This radio station mm-hmm. was one of the first radio stations in the country.
Right.
And it was a group of people here who were very advanced at that point in terms of what they were doing with this new wireless technology, who started this radio station and therefore brought radio to rural Wisconsin at an age when, you know, they thought like that had never happened. That really connected people mm-hmm. to the world in a number of ways. And, you know, those sorts of pieces of our history are important.
And yeah. You seem to be traveling the state. I saw a picture on the UW website where you're knee-deep in cranberries.
I was out in a cranberry marsh.
Tell us about that. Why were you in a cranberry marsh?
So, I actually have one of the things that I love doing, and I did this in the Department of Commerce, and it's one of the best parts of that job and this job, is to go out and visit different businesses in the state and talk about how they are connected to the university and, you know, how we can help them to get the sort of workers they need or to work with them on some of the innovation and research fronts. I was out at the Oshkosh Truck Company, I think in September, right before they got that big federal contract to manufacture these huge transport vehicles. They're trucks, but really amazing trucks. I got a ride in one of these that can be used in almost any terrain. And those are going to supply the military for the next decade. So 2 weeks ago, I got to go to a cranberry farm. And while I have been to a lot of different farms, I've got a lot of relatives who are on farms in the state of Missouri. I've never been to a cranberry farm. And it was really interesting to see both the size and scope of this operation, as well as the level of capitalization that was required to, set up these marshes and put the watering systems together and sculpt the land in the way that I was just really impressed with what they were doing. I learned, which I did not know and should have, that the cranberry is the state fruit of the state of Wisconsin, and that we produce more than half of all the cranberries used in the world.
So I didn't know that either.
It was a really interesting visit, and I love the picture on our website where the dean of the College of Agriculture, Kate Vandenbosch, and I got to put on waders and go out into the cranberry marsh itself.
I'm amazed. I've been at UW as a professor for over 30 years, but I'm amazed how much about this university I still don't know because it's so huge. Can you give us some sense of the scope of UW-Madison, and also how it fits into the UW system? And you're chancellor of UW-Madison, but then there's also the UW system that we're part of, and we're a flagship organization.
Yeah, let me talk a little about the scope of Madison, because it's one of the things that makes this such a fun job is, there's such a wide range of issues and activities out there that the university does that one can go and engage in at any time. One of the things that's really unique about UW-Madison, and it gives us some enormous strength in today's world of research and education, is that we are one of the few universities, even among the big publics, that has everything on one contiguous campus. So we have, within a long walk, admittedly, but about a mile of each other, the entire health sciences area, this huge hospital, all of the medical school and public health, pharmacy, nursing. You start moving eastward, you get to the vet med school, you then have all of the College of Agriculture and life sciences and all of its life sciences and biotechnological research that's associated with that, and that in turn overlaps with the health sciences. And then you have all the professional schools. You've got law and business. You've got education. You've got the School of Human Ecology, which grew out of the College of Agriculture. You've got the College of Engineering. And then all of the liberal arts and the full range from the humanities to the natural and physical sciences and the social sciences. And having all of that together on one campus, as I say, is quite unusual. It gives us enormous both educational strength and research strength, because it says that students can come here and pursue an enormously wide range of interests and areas of study. So, you don't come and, we're good in this area, so everyone goes and becomes a biologist. But let's say you also are actually sort of interested in dance. Well, you can do that as a minor. Or you're interested in some aspect of, what's happening in astronomy and meteorology. We're really strong in that area, so you could go take courses there. So it gives us this breadth of education, which I think is just wonderful for people you're educating to be global citizens in a changing world. At the same time, as it really gives us strength in these big interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary research projects that take on big scientific questions and which you can't deal with just out of one discipline or one perspective, and where you need the chemists and the biologists and the neurologists and people from the School of Social Work and Psychology working on brain studies or, working on things that are deeply important to society. Increasingly, the research money is going to big interdisciplinary projects of this sort. And one of the reasons we are as successful as we are as a research institution and are going to continue to be successful is we're very well set up for that because of our size and our scope and what we have here on this campus.
At the same time, that size and the scope can be overwhelming for someone coming to this school from a small town. I always remember I had a literature class for 400 undergraduates. They would then go to discussion sections. But I had one student who was, I think, from Oconto Falls or Balsam Lake or somewhere. And she said there were more people in that one class than in her whole town. Mm-hmm. And it was overwhelming to her. I suggested that she sit in the front row and kind of for a while and just kind of almost pretend that that size wasn't there. What do you say to someone who is looking at it as big in terms of just overwhelming? How do you compete with this, the experience of a small liberal arts college?
So I actually think that's something we do quite well here. If you go and ask students, you know, gosh, what did you think coming here? What were you most worried about? How did it go? I can promise you that 9 out of 10 students will tell you that what most worried them when they were coming here was that this was so big and they wouldn't find a group of friends. They'd get a little lost. They wouldn't know what was happening. And almost inevitably, when students say that, they laugh and say within a week, you know, that was gone. And some of this, of course, is we really do want our first year students living in the dorms, living with each other, getting to know each other. And we work hard at trying to create those communities and to get people interacting early on. We have this wonderful activity called the First Year Interest Groups, FIGs, that increasing numbers of our freshmen are taking, which puts groups of students together with some shared interests and puts them into some special classes with some additional special writing exercises, which is also very good educationally, and gets them into a small learning community so they get to know each other. And then, of course, we have something like you know, 1,000 different student organizations on campus. And we really encourage students from the very beginning to, you know, get involved in some student organization. So you get to know people through your dorm. You might get to, you get to know them through some of those first year classes if you, you know, particularly if you're in one of these FIGs. You get to know them through the, you know, student activities. And then, you know, you meet people quickly. You know, one of the good things about such a large campus is it's actually pretty easy to find folks who share some of your interests, and that's good. Now, some people do get lost, and it's one of the reasons why we really work in the dorms to have, you know, dorm assistants and people there who, you know, try to pay attention to, or their students are just staying in the room all day, or their students who are getting lost, students who aren't quite making it, because then you do have to do some of that outreach as well, and you need eyes on the students to do that, which is one reason why the dorms are helpful for that.
You also have the honors program to try to create sort of special activities for those who want to go beyond. Another thing that another program that, that you inherited but seem to have embraced, maybe because of your original English major background, just is the Go Big Read idea that the whole campus will have a book and then there will be discussions around that. With this year's Just Mercy book, it seemed as if it was picked up by a lot of different classes in interesting ways. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, we do pick a book every year. We try to get it out to the community. We hand it out to all of our freshmen at commencement and really encourage classes across the university to try to find ways to use this. So we often try to take a book that can be used in science classes as well as in social studies or humanities classes. And this year, we actually just sort of had the coming together of the right book at the right time with Just Mercy by Brian Stevens. Mr. Stevenson is a legal aid lawyer who has set up an organization down in Alabama that basically, you know, works with low-income individuals and particularly people on death row. He's done a lot of work with children who are sentenced to lifetime in prison at age 13. And this book is just beautifully written. It sort of tells stories of what he's experienced in the criminal justice system. And, of course, putting this book against the public events of the last year, including the events here in Madison with the Tony Robinson shooting, just enormous interest in this question of particularly racial justice and other forms of justice in the criminal justice system, and how should we be thinking about that. And, you know, this book, I think, really got a lot of people into that issue at a level of deeper interest and commitment. So we had a huge crowd when he came to speak. We've had more classes using this book than we've ever seen before. It's just been incredibly effective. And, you know, it's another way to pull the community together. When you have a community this big, you need to be doing things that create shared identity. And, you know, Go Big Read, in many ways, is not unlike the Saturday football games, right? It pulls the community community together. It brings them together around a common set of interests and something everyone can talk about with a similar language, regardless of where they come from. And you always have to be looking for those opportunities in a big institution like this.
I know former Dean of Students Mary Rouse once said that it sometimes to the community could seem as if there was a drawbridge up at the other end of Park Street, that mm-hmm. in South Madison, where the income level mm-hmm. is lower, traditionally those of color, and then looking down to North Park Street with the campus, mm-hmm. that sometimes it seemed as if it was in its own world and not welcoming them there. What other kinds of programs would you say there are that are, you know, because we've seen the race to equity report mm-hmm. with Dane County actually having a terrible record in terms of the achievement gap, economic disparities, and so on. How do you see sort of the university mm-hmm. and then this larger community, particularly the low-income areas of Madison that feel excluded?
Yes, you know, we are part of this community. Our faculty and staff work here. Many of our students live here for many years. And we've got to be part of community challenges. And certainly some of the challenges around inequalities, and particularly racial inequalities in the schools, and the poverty differentials and the employment differentials are important for the university to be very closely involved with. And, you know, there's a lot of ways in which we get involved with the community. We actually did a survey of, you know, sort of all of our faculty and staff saying, are you doing anything that's community involved? And what came back to us was, you know, literally 1,000 different initiatives, many of which we at Bascom Hall knew nothing about. But let me mention a few of the major things that I think are really quite important for the university. The first, and I take this very seriously, is encouraging our students to be involved in the community as we call them badger volunteers. Mm-hmm. The Margaret Center for Public Service, I think last year, placed some 1,500 students as volunteers in the community, many of them tutoring in the schools, working exactly on mm-hmm. some of those outcome gaps. And, you know, that's a win-win. Not only, I hope, is that very good for the community, for the schools, for the people that serving, but it's great for our students. It's out-of-classroom education and out-of-classroom experiences in a world they might not otherwise see. So that's one. Secondly, as you know, we, about a year ago, opened a sort of off-campus little piece of the university down on South Park Street at the Old Villager Mall. Mm-hmm. And we are running a variety of programs out of that, both educational programs. We have some public health programs going with some of the low-income communities and communities of color around things like prostate cancer and, you know, certain health issues. Our legal aid clinic from the law school works out of there, and you run your Odyssey program, I think, meets
right.
there frequently.
Yes, it does.
And that presence, I think, is important. We're hoping to do a number of admissions events there this year to make it clear that when we talk about coming to the university, we're not just talking to the kids of faculty members, but we're talking to the entire community. So that's important. The third thing I'd mention is something called Forward Madison, which is a collaboration between some people at our School of Education and the Madison Public Schools. CUNA Mutual has put money into this, and you know, I actually put a good amount of my discretionary funds into this as well, because I think it's so important that we're working directly on some of those educational equity issues. And Forward Madison is working on mentoring teachers. It's working on trying to create a pipeline of high school students from communities of color coming into the School of Education. There's a whole variety of pieces of that particular initiative, and I'm quite excited about it, and I think it seems to be doing good things as it unfolds.
That's great. I'm going to turn to some questions about challenges and frustrations and changes here at UW-Madison when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach. Today, we memorialize the late Chancellor Emerita Rebecca Blank by rebroadcasting an interview with her about her role as chancellor when she was a third of her way into the 9-year tenure. I asked her about the famous plaque at the UW. Whatever may be the limitations which trammel inquiry elsewhere, we believe that the great state University of Wisconsin should ever encourage that continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth can be found. Those are the words on a plaque given by the class of 1910 to the University of Wisconsin, speaking to the issue of academic freedom. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Chancellor Rebecca Blank, and we are talking about being chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I was just going to ask you what that plaque, what those words, the sifting and winnowing idea, mean to you.
So I love those words, and those are words that are quoted around the country and even around the world as the bedrock of how a university should think about itself and how the public around the university should think of it. Those words came out of a dispute over actually an economist who was getting quite involved with progressive politics, and it was proposed that he should be dismissed from his position since he was obviously speaking out on issues that some people were not happy in ways that people were not happy with. And the Board of Regents took this up, and those words come out of a Board of Regents decision that essentially says, it's a very early statement of academic freedom, that a university should have people from all viewpoints. It should be, people's ideas can go anywhere. There's nothing that's not thinkable around a university, and that we have to protect that. And that type of sifting and winnowing of all ideas and of really open discussion and open research is important to protect at a public university. And those words have been tested again and again, not just at Wisconsin, but elsewhere, because there often is a conflict between the perceived ideas of the day and where certain university faculty are going and what they're saying and what research they're doing. And I take it as very important for our university, for any major public university, to protect itself and to protect its academic freedom. And of course, with those words to quote here, we have a great heritage.
I would think it's sometimes difficult because just as with the ACLU defending, maybe the right of Nazis mm-hmm. to march in Skokie, or, sometimes you may be defending the right to hold opinions that are actually feel horrible to you personally. Have you mm-hmm. found in the 2.5 years that you've been chancellor a situation where you are needing as a university to defend faculty or defend ideas or defend things that really seem antithetical to certain other principles?
I have not had to defend, I think, some of the cases that I know some of my colleagues elsewhere have had to. There's always a little bit of upset of certain things happening here on campus by either legislators or other people. One of the things that I'm perhaps most disturbed about, and I understand that people can agree or disagree with this, are the some of the current attacks on climate change and on some of the climate and environmental science that is being done. And that's something that I think we need to defend on our campus. And again, whether you would agree or disagree with the outcomes that are being presented there, it is very valid research and research that needs to move forward.
I think it also comes up sometimes with student organizations, mm-hmm. which kinds of political views, which kinds of topics, which things can come under the umbrella of the student organization and where student fees can go toward those groups.
Yes, and you often see this as well when there are invitations to certain speakers on campus. And again, we haven't had a really huge upset over something in the way that some other campuses have in the last couple of years since I've been here. But it could happen at any time that people invite a speaker who many folks find their views really antithetical. And, my reaction as a university is about open dialogue. And you can't shout people down because you disagree with them on a university. You've got to owe them the respect of listening to them. You can disagree with them in many, many ways. But again, university is a place where any idea should be thinkable. And then we can debate it, right? And people can come up in violent disagreement of it. But it's a place where those ideas can be debated, whether you like them or don't like them. And that does make universities uncomfortable places oftentimes, and places where you have to keep defending this idea of academic freedom and freedom of thought.
So what keeps you up at night? Like if you find yourself sort of worrying or feeling stress, what are the issues that do that for you?
So I've obviously been quite worried about our financial situation, and I do think my biggest long-term challenge at this university is finding a financial model for this university that relies less and less on state funding, but that also which allows broad spread access, not just to people from across Wisconsin, but also to a very diverse group of students, both low income and higher income. And as state dollars continue to shrink, and as we're under, we have lots of conversations about where should tuition dollars be set. These are just really hard conversations. We are a truly excellent university across a range of issues. And to maintain excellence costs money. It takes mm-hmm. a lot of other things as well, but it does cost money. We are not a cheap place to operate. And if we, Could we provide education at a much lower rate? Yes, but it wouldn't be the same quality of a university. And that would be a true loss to the state in all sorts of ways. So trying to figure out how we maintain this stable financial base and, you know, working with the state legislator on that, communicating with the citizens of the state, working with the with our stakeholders inside, with our students. As you know, we've raised out-of-state tuition. We've raised some of our professional school tuition. I think those things should be set at a market rate. And that's an argument and a discussion I'm willing to have. And then we can come back and talk about what should be the subsidy to in-state students and how do we set that? What sort of financial aid should we be getting? Should we be generating ourselves or getting from the state? Equally important in this world of financial issues is the importance of doing fundraising from your friends and alumni. And as you know, we've launched a new fundraising campaign publicly just a few weeks ago. And that is deeply important. There's not an institution of higher education in this country, public or private, that doesn't understand that one important branch of its financial stability has to come from alumni fundraising. And we've got a wonderful group of alumni to work with on that.
You've already mentioned the Mortgage Center, named after the mortgages. Mm-hmm. That's sort of an unprecedented amount of gift money, isn't it, that has come from John and Tasha Mortgage?
John and Tasha Mortgage are our most generous donors, and they're wonderful people, not just to the university, but to the state. They've done a number of things around the state that go well beyond the university. We had a gift this last year from the mortgages, which I know many people know something about, but it's a story I just love to tell. Almost exactly a year ago, it was, I think, our last home football game, right, excepting Thanksgiving. It was sometime in early November. We publicly announced a matching gift from John and Tasha Mortgage, where they put $100 million out there to be matched by other individuals to support faculty chairs and professorships. And let me just say, in the academic world, that being a chaired faculty member is sort of a coin of the realm. It's an indication that you know, really are top rated among your colleagues. And we have very few chairs compared to many of our peers. I mean, you know, just we have very little, few of those to give. That's not something I could ever use state dollars for or tuition dollars. I can't use federal research dollars. You need private money, and you endow a chair, and it not only covers a part of someone's salary, but it also gives them research funding that, you know, they can use in all sorts of ways to start new projects before they're ready to go out and, you know, apply for grants from other places. So they put $100 million on the table to fund faculty chairs. And we had a number of conversations with mortgages, as well as myself, with the head of our development operation, about how many years it would take us to get that money matched. Well, within 6 months, we had to go to John and Tasha and say, you know, we're at $95 million. We've still got 30 active conversations that haven't closed. How do we close this off? Do we just sort of say, last one in the door, all the rest of you are out of luck? And John and Tasha, being the generous people they are, said, well, let's do the following. Let's set a final date. And anything that you can generate by that final date, we will match. And if you don't make $100 million, we aren't going to match $100 million. But if you go over, we'll match wherever you are. So we set the date of June 8th, which was, I think, was about 7 months after this got announced. And as of June 8th, we had $125 million in matching money. John and Tasha matched that. So that gave us essentially $250 million in new endowed funds for faculty chairs. It more than doubled the number of chaired professorships that we have available at this university. Every school and college in the university had some of these mortgage-matched chairs. We had a wonderful celebration of this just a couple of weeks ago, and this is a transformative gift for the university. In the long run, it's transformative because of our ability to recruit and retain top faculty members. In the short run, it's transformative because of the momentum it gives us, of the sense of what we can do with our alumni to support things at this university that I say I can't support with state or tuition dollars, that are in many ways a margin of excellence for the school that will keep us among one of the top universities in the world.
Well, what about the flip side of sort of fundraising, which is sometimes those who give money also expect to have more influence, or there are strings attached. I know, even on a very small scale, when I do fundraising for the UW Odyssey Project, where I'm dependent on, you know, over 1,000 donors, sometimes people say, well, you can have this money if you do A, B, and C, or so, earmark it for something that doesn't seem quite fair. Money comes with its own problems.
Yes, and let me say, there's two things to be said about that. One is, you can't take every gift that is offered you. You have to know when to say no. And if people are offering you gifts that don't fit your priorities, or even more so, there are many gifts that actually take money. You know, they eat mm-hmm. other resources. And if it's not part of your priorities, you've got to know when to say no. When I was a dean and first starting to do fundraising, I took a gift that I should never have taken, and it ended up with the giver backing out of it. But it just we couldn't mm-hmm. use it. And I was so excited about getting this big gift, but that I never stopped to think, but how would we actually make this work? And I learned a real lesson there. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone in fundraising will tell you there's some things you say no to. The other comment I'd make is that we write gift agreements with everyone. We are very clear about what this gift does and doesn't do. So, for instance, if you endow a chair, you do not have any right to help select the person who's going to hold that chair. That is what the departments do as they set their priorities and determine. Now, you could say this is a chair in Norwegian studies, and mm-hmm. the department has to follow that, but you can't select which Norwegian studies scholar gets to come. So, you know, we work very hard on those gift agreements to make it quite clear to donors that we are deeply appreciative of this gift, but it doesn't mean that they can tell us how to run the department or the place in which they're giving money. And our good donors understand that, but it is something you have to constantly talk about and think about.
Another yeah. thing that can happen sometimes if you're in fundraising mode, I find this with the small, you know, Odyssey program that I speak about, is you can feel you have to always put, I guess it's sort of almost like boosterism or showcasing, you have to stress the positives if you're wanting to get donations, yeah. when inside you might be wanting to say, oh, but there's this failure, or I'm frustrated yeah. by this, or here's something we're not doing well. When, I mean, I think it's also important to be able to be yeah. very honest about some of the things that maybe mm-hmm. UW-Madison is lagging behind yeah. its peers or could do better. Yeah. And not feel always as if you have to sort of make a case.
And I should say that's not just an issue of fundraising. That's an issue of how do you talk about the university with the legislature, with the citizens of the state, and with those inside the university. And I always think it's one of the real balances that anyone in leadership in these institutions is always walking along a knife edge of, on the one hand, nobody wants the leader to stand up and talk about everything that's going wrong and all the challenges mm-hmm. and how they just can't take it anymore.
Yeah,
you know, just,
right.
you know, I've known people who, whenever they open their mouth, they sort of give you this downer sermon.
Right.
And, you know, it's, and you get tired of it, right? On the other hand, you can't just be the booster, right?
Right.
You have to be, if you don't have a pretty honest and clear-eyed view of this institution and where it's doing well and where it isn't, you can't lead it, right? And so I know whenever I go out and talk, you know, we've recently been through some rather difficult budget decisions with the state legislature, and we're doing some things that are really hurting at the university in terms of budget cuts. But you know, whenever I talk, I try to talk with a both and. Look, there's some wonderful things happening at the university, things we should all be proud of. I'm highlighting either on the education or the research side. At the same time, I always say, but there are challenges, and they're challenges we have to be thinking about hard because they threaten this university and they threaten some of the things we're doing. And you've got to constantly be talking on that both and front. And, you know, for your long-term and really major donors, they understand. I mean, in fact, if you aren't honest with them, or if you aren't transparent with them, they know everything we do isn't well done. The legislature mm-hmm. knows that. My faculty know that. And so if you don't stand up and talk about some of the things that need to be improved and some of the problems you have, that you lose credibility with that as well.
So let's hear yeah. about some of those. I mean, and you've yeah. been at Michigan. You know, yeah. you've been at many other universities. What do you sort of envy about what's at other institutions, land grant or the Ivy Leagues? And, you know, what do you see as some of the areas that really need to be addressed?
So I really think the biggest frustration that I have hit around this university beyond sort of short-term issues is the level of micromanagement that we are under as a state agency. There are very few of our peer institutions, almost none, that are state agencies in the way that we are, subject to every requirement of the state in terms of how we operate. And the constraints that places upon us as we make decisions and try to operate and move flexibly and be nimble as the world is changing around us are enormous. And, you know, particularly when people tell me you need to run this more like a business, you need to be nimble, you need to be changing, I just want to look at them because it's often coming from state officials and say, give me some freedom to do that. So, for instance, let me give you an example. And I should not be wasting my time on these things. The audit bureau at the state about a year ago raised a question about whether we could actually be spending the money that we generate from parking revenues to cross-fund our bus system and our safe ride system and, you know, all, you know, mm-hmm. the bicycle racks. And, you know, we were using this broadly to fund transportation. And we'd been doing it for years and years and years. And they looked at the legislation that governs this by the state and determined that legislation was ambiguous and that we had to stop doing that. We could only use our parking revenues for parking. Well, that suddenly, you know, that would have left us with a $4 million hole every year. I mean, we, you know, we have 13,000 parking spaces and we have 60,000 people who come to campus. You know, buses and bikes are a very important part of transportation, and these are all integrated together, and I can't just dump the bus system, right? So I can tell you, I've been up talking to legislators. My senior people have been. We have spent months and months and months, and there is now legislation in front of both the House and the Senate to add one word. I think it's one word, maybe it's two, to the statute that allows us to use this money to fund the full transportation system, not just parking. Now,
that's
this
a good
is not
example.
Worth our time. It's a great example. I mean, we should have discretion to run this university effectively. That's what I was hired to do. That's who I hire my senior staff for. And spending time on things like that is just a complete waste of time and energy on everyone's part. So I know there's been a lot of discussion about flexibilities around the university and indeed across the whole system. And I have to say that just has to happen. That has to happen, or we are not going to be able to be the sort of university system, not just Madison, but the whole system, that this state needs.
And how do you see the relationship between, I think we never quite got to the UW-Madison relationship to UW-Richland Center, you know, UW-Whitewater, the extension. You know, we are part of a system. Yeah. How is that both a plus and a negative from your standpoint as chancellor?
Well, I think it's a plus in several ways. You know, one is that there are a lot of people here who have different needs as they come into higher education, right? And some people are better prepared and some are not. And the University of Wisconsin at Madison is, you know, it's a research one university. It's a really top rated. We cut pretty high in terms of test scores and GPAs and people's background as to who we admit. And if we were, you know, a ship on our own bottom, there'd be a lot, many more complaints about the fact that people couldn't get in. And the fact that we have a huge system of universities, many of them really, really fine. Eau Claire, Whitewater, Milwaukee, those are really first-rate comprehensive universities. And it is, you know, it gives, you know, and then, of course, you go to the two-year schools as well. It gives people a range of choices here. And many people will start at particularly the two-year schools and then transfer into Madison. And for many people, that is the right way to start. Okay. So that mix of opportunities for the state in terms of getting people into higher education from where they are, I think is highly important. Okay. The other advantage to us is we do have a single shared budget request to the state legislature. I don't go up there and argue for Madison, and Eau Claire goes up and argues for Eau Claire, and Richland Center argues for Richland Center. That would be a disaster. I've been in states where that's true, and sort of every university for itself doing its own politics. And doing this is a unified way across the entire system is a far, far better and saner way for us to do our budgets every 2 years. Now, however frustrating the budget process may be, it would be a whole lot worse if we weren't in a system. Now, the frustrations of the system are also very real. And, you know, we are different from many of the other schools. And sometimes we sort of have needs that are different. We can do things some of the other schools can do. So, for instance, we have a really first-rate group of lawyers. Many other schools use the system lawyers because they just aren't big enough to have their own legal system, their own legal section. We have our own legal section. We need it, given our size and scope. So there's always tensions between us and the system. I mean, that's just sort of inevitable if you're the flagship with a system that's serving a lot of schools that aren't like you. And so we're constantly talking with the system about why we need a little exception here or why this doesn't work for us. And, you know, sometimes we win and sometimes we lose those things. And but that's just part of doing business.
More with the chancellor when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Emily Auerbach. When he learned of the passing of Chancellor Rebecca Blank, Barack Obama wrote, "Whether in government or academia, she devoted her career to reducing inequality and increasing opportunities for others, and she made everyone around her better." We remember Chancellor Blank today with a rebroadcast of an interview with her about her role as chancellor when the job was pretty new to her, including what a typical day looks like and why she loves the job.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Chancellor Rebecca Blank, and we are talking about sort of the life of a chancellor. Give us a sense of a day in the life of a chancellor.
Well, one of the reasons I love this job is that no day is like another, right? There's mm-hmm. always new things to do, and that's fun. I probably spend, if you sort of average it, a week is a little easier because I'm probably out of the office at least one day a week on average that I'll be, either out around the state or I'll be at a meeting or out in D.C. or, doing something. I spend probably 25% of my time in one form or another on fundraising. Now, much of that is travel where I go out to visit alums and, am out of the office. I probably spend 30 to 40% of my time on what I think of as the management. I meet every Tuesday with all of my senior executive team. With some of them, I meet one-on-one after we have a shared meeting. I'm going through what are the issues of the day, what's happening in your area, what's happening in my area, what do we both need to talk about, what's coming up as the next crisis that we've mm-hmm. got to keep our eyes on. So there's a good amount of that. And then there's the rest of the time really is what I think of as, meet and greet. I mean, it's going out to places in the community, going out to places around campus and going to a student event, meeting with a department, going to an award ceremony, giving a talk.
Anything bizarre that you've been asked to do because you are a sort of a public figure with Bucky Badger and all kinds of other things? You are the face of the university. Anything where you found yourself doing something where you had to laugh about it?
I love Bucky Badger. I have to say he is my favorite person. I do admit I get asked to do some things and I sort of, my husband looks at me and says, you know? There's a band that's a volunteer band that plays out in one of the parks every summer that is largely made up of university-related people, some of them retirees, and I get asked every summer to come and conduct something with that band, and it's, I've only been able to do it one summer, but I hope they'll ask me again. It was great fun, but I can't say that's a skill that I ever thought I had.
Yeah.
And you show up at various events that are, well, you just learn something. It's like going to the Cranberry Marsh.
Mm-hmm.
It's an opportunity to learn something at the same time that you can talk about the university and how it can be involved in this. And, that's just fun. It is always a question of, this is always the question in politics of when do you put a funny hat on and when don't you, right? And there's people say never put a funny hat on. But, in this job in particular where you're working with students, you can't take yourself too seriously. You do have to go out occasionally and be a little silly with things.
And so
I went out and one of the things that our student services does is they run bingo games. So my husband and I went out and called bingo one night. That was really fun. I hope we'll get to do that again.
And I'm sure it was all over social media. And that leads me to another question, which is not just with social media, but in mm-hmm. general, one thing that I see is so radically different here on campus from back when I was an undergraduate mm-hmm. is technology mm-hmm. in all kinds of ways, changing how a university functions. Can you talk about that and how you see technology something very different than it would have been even 2 years ago or 5 years ago.
Yeah, you mentioned social media, and of course that really has changed things and how you get messages out and how things can go viral that cause problems. And so you've always got to be working on communications. It's a 24/7 job of a sort that 20 years ago, communications was keeping in touch with two or three key people at each of the state newspapers, and mm-hmm. That was about it. So that job has changed enormously with technology. I think the biggest potential advantage of technology for our campus is the ways that we can use some of these new technologies to expand and improve our educational mission. Of course, there's all sorts of technical changes in research, that goes without saying, but on the educational front, I think the biggest effect of these new educational technologies for a big public university like Wisconsin is not on our ability to do distance learning, though of course we will want and are mm-hmm. engaging in that, but in our ability to do a better job of delivering those huge introductory classes that used to be 400 people with a speck of an instructor standing in front mm-hmm. of the room and everyone in the back half was reading and looking at something else. And increasingly, we have technological tools available to flip those classrooms, to have them acquire the lecture knowledge elsewhere and to bring them together and have them interact with other students, interact with TAs and faculty, solve problems together, to be engaged in active learning. And all of the research is saying that the more you can do active learning, not just sit and listen, chalk and talk, the more that people learn and the more they retain. And you can see this in the outcomes of these classes. So we've got a new initiative going in which we're trying to you know, go through the various big introductory classes in the departments that teach them and engage them in a conversation about how they can use some of these new technologies more effectively in those classes. And we've got some departments doing a great job of that and some departments that we need to do some nudging on. So there's, it's one of the exciting things about higher education right now is the new technologies make a number of things possible and expand your sense of how you can deliver education in really interesting ways and just really fun and challenging to think about how you use those well.
It can be exciting. There's also something that sometimes feels to me like a loss when I go into the library and see everybody on a computer and nobody actually in the stacks, because the whole way that we retrieve information is so different. And I see that my granddaughters are growing up knowing that you can just ask your phone for a piece of information.
You're clearly my age and not the age of your daughters and granddaughters, right? No, I love a hard copy newspaper, right? I can't imagine anything less satisfying than sitting down with your newspaper on a Sunday. But that's not the way a lot of 20-year-olds think. And we've got to adapt our teaching to where people are. And it's one of the things about universities that are exciting. You have to change if you're around a university because the students are changing. And that keeps you young.
You have to change, but you also have to keep defending, I think, the value of the core liberal arts, even when it seems they might be impractical or others. I saw on one of your blog postings, because you have a blank, what is it called, blank slate?
Blank slate.
Yeah, that's a clever use of your name. Something about the graduation retention rates being quite good here at UW-Madison.
So we just got the numbers for the last academic year, and over the last 6 years, I believe now, we have steadily seen an increase in our retention rates from freshman to sophomore year. We're now at 96%, which is as good as, better than almost any publics and as good as many of the small privates are. If you look at our graduation rates, those have gone up steadily over the last 6 years, and we're now well above the average of our peers. And our time to graduation is falling. And that's very important, particularly because that's highly linked to student debt and the amount of student debt students take on. There are a number of things we've been doing that help that, not the least of which was a big infusion of money about 6 years ago. That's been spent, however, and we're thinking about a number of other ways to move forward because we don't have money to put into this. It is incredibly important, I think, that we keep making progress on those outcomes. I'm very proud of those outcomes, and they are at least one indication that this is one of the top public universities in the country to attend if you're a senior in high school.
I saw UW referred to as a public Ivy League school, so that's kind of an interesting phrase. So imagine that I have you back in 5 years. We're both still doing this job. I'm doing mine, you're doing yours. What do you hope in 5 years will be different? You know, what would have changed? What kinds of things do you see in the future?
Yeah, you know, universities are, they change slowly. And as you say, there's certain fundamental aspects of universities about, you know, open ideas and research and as well as the mix of classes and the commitment to a liberal arts background and a distribution of classes. We aren't not teaching people for specific jobs, which we're building career skills for them. And that's not going to change. But, you know, my guess is that the whole biomedical area will continue to grow in strength and in presence and the number of majors going into that field. I think that whole area of the economy is going to grow. And so I think that will continue to expand. I would hope in 5 years that we're a little further along the line of, if you ask me, how are you going to make this place financially stable over the long run with ongoing state cuts? Have you worked out some agreements with tuition and how you move forward? That will have happened. And similarly, I hope that we might have achieved a few flexibilities so that we can manage a little more nimbly as well. You know, we'll see where that goes. I would hope we've made some real progress when we talk about technological change. I'm going to be able to point to some parts of the university where we're delivering education differently. And lastly, let me tell you about one thing we're doing that I'm very excited about. One thing we've never done here is strategically used our summer. You know, a lot of our buildings sit empty. So one of the things we're starting to think about is how do we strategically and creatively think about a summer curriculum on this campus, not just for our regular students, because there are many students who do stay here over the summer and pick up one course. They don't have to stay a last quarter, maybe, that would, you know, otherwise add a lot more expense. But how do we use it as well entrepreneurially to bring people to this campus to take a week of course or a month-long course or a course in the arts or in the languages or in science for policymakers, things that might both generate some additional revenue but also really expand our educational mission here in the state and around the country. So I'm very excited about that, and I hope if we come back in 5 years, we'll be able to talk about how summer in Madison has changed, because what better time to bring people to Madison for a week or a month than the summer? It's no more beautiful time in the state.
Right, and they can go out on the Union Terrace in the trademark chairs and so on. Yeah. I assume you could also do some teacher training workshops because teachers are off in the summer.
You can start thinking about all the things you can do as professional certification or educational add-ons or bringing international students here for a month or two who might be, you know, interested in engaging in one form or another with a U.S. university and a U.S. community. There's lots of opportunities there.
Well, look forward to that conversation. And I thank you for being here as my guest.
Thank you, Emily.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and we honor Rebecca Blank's passing today by remembering her with this rebroadcast of an earlier interview. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.